So I want to start with just a short excerpt from a poem by William Butler Yeats. So it's not too long, so just to set the tone. The falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. Welcome to Bible Study for Progressives, a show where moderates, liberals, and leftists of all faiths and ideologies come together to discuss scripture, spirituality, and politics. We engage scripture in its historical context, plumb its depths for wisdom and guidance, and apply its lessons to current events and social issues. Whether you're a liberal evangelical, a New Age spiritualist, a social justice activist, or a postmodern theologian, there's something in this show for you. Come, be energized in spirit and mind to understand the word and what it means to be a spiritual person in today's world. I want to begin with some introductions. Alan Minsky is the director of Progressive Democrats of America. He's a lifelong activist. He's worked as a progressive journalist for the past two decades. He was the program director at KPFK Los Angeles from 2009 to 2018. He's coordinated Pacifica Radio's national coverage of elections. Before that, he was a founder of LA Indie Media. And he's the creator and producer of political podcasts for The Nation and Jacobin Magazine, as well as a contributor to Common Dreams and Truth Dig. My name is Rich Procida. I'm an author, attorney, and journalist, and I'm organizing this PDA chapter. And I write about religion and politics at laprogressive.com, and I produce a news and politics podcast called Bible Study for Progressives. The first thing I want to say is that I do not believe Trump will succeed in his attempts to overthrow democracy. Everything everyone did to protect the integrity of the election, from poll watchers to de-escalation trainings to getting out the vote, were critical to winning and making the results stand up. We have put ourselves in a very good position and are likely to prevail this time. At the same time, we must remain vigilant. We don't know what Trump will do, but I'm afraid we have an idea of how far he's willing to go. Right after it became clear that he had lost the election, he put loyalists in charge of the Defense Department. Then on Friday, he removed 11 of the 13 members of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board. So think about this for a moment. He's already prepared to use military force to put down protest. He's preparing just in case one of his schemes to overturn the results proves successful. He's still trying to overthrow our democracy. Though he's losing in court, he's still trying to kick the case to the Supreme Court, where he will have a chance of winning. He's trying to get electors to overturn the results. And I don't believe it when he says he will leave if the electors choose Biden. On Friday, he said Joe Biden can't enter the White House unless he proves that his votes were not fraudulent. And today he said he wouldn't accept the result for 6 months. I think he's buying time, telling us to look the other way. Nothing happening here, while he plots behind our backs. He may have no choice but to leave if he can't put together a military force to put down the resistance, and that's something he probably will be unable to do. Indy Samra Rajiva, a writer from Sri Lanka, wrote an article about his experience of living through an attempted coup in 2018. He defined a coup literally as a blow, a strike, someone hitting your normal processes of government, trying to knock them over. He wrote, "The blow doesn't have to succeed. It still wounds." In his case, it was occupying parliament without a majority. In ours, it's denying the president-elect after the election. Whether it fails or not, deep structural damage has been done. At the time, however, it just feels dumb. Chancy De Vega, in a recent article in Salon, wrote, "American democracy is very sick. The jubilance and celebration at Trump's apparent defeat on Election Day were highly premature. Biden's victory was a drug that temporarily masked the pain of a democracy in critical condition. The patient can live normally until the high of the drug wears off. The crash will be extreme and horrible, almost beyond imagination, because the underlying disease has not been addressed." Sama Rajari describes it like this: "Your Republicans have set forces into play they cannot possibly understand and certainly cannot control. And they don't even want to. To them, chaos is a ladder. You've opened up a Pandora's box of instability. All kinds of demons come out. I've lived through a coup. It felt like what you're feeling right now, like watching something stupid and just waiting for it to go away. But it doesn't go away. There's a ticking time bomb at the heart of your democracy now. Your government, the very idea of governance, is fatally wounded. Chaos has been planted at its heart. I don't know what this chaos will grow into, but I can promise you this. It won't be good." Odilon Kamara, an economist at USC Marshall School of Business who studies voting, elections, and polarizations, writes, "The truth of what Trump and his neo-fascist movement have revealed about America's failures and vulnerabilities must be confronted if the civic disease is to be purged from the country's body politic. The reckoning must also include an assessment of the character and behavior of the tens of millions of Americans who voted for Trump and continue to support him." She describes polarization as a remarkably effective political strategy. "Trump's lasting popularity makes it clear that our current level of polarization is not an accidental byproduct of politics. It's an intentional strategy on the part of politicians. If I'm a politician and the odds are in my favor, I want to reduce the probability that voters will cross the aisle by removing any lingering uncertainty and solidifying my support. One of the best ways to do this is by taking more extreme positions that differentiate me from my opponent. Rather than simply pledging to curb immigration, rile up crowds by promising to build a wall. At the same time, I paint my opponent as equally extreme, as a socialist seeking to tear down the American way of life, or as a capitalist in the pockets of greedy billionaires. Drawing a stark line between myself and my opponent on divisive issues pushes voters in the middle to pick a side, while at the same time mobilizing my base." She also points out that technology and media create echo chambers where more extreme positions resonate and platforms where candidates can deliver divisive messages directly to voters. Campaigns have better data about voter preferences, more sophisticated marketing strategies, and they can use these to identify and leverage divides in the electorate. This has to have to play some role in the 73 million votes Trump got. There are no easy solutions, she says. Educating voters to critically evaluate information and focusing on areas of consensus could take the air out of politicians' attempts to fixate on the most polarizing hot-button issues. So could an expansion of ballot initiatives and other forms of direct democracy that focus on issues rather than politicians. Ruth Ben-Ghiat, a leading historian of fascism, said, "We are going to need a lot of grassroots education to help people understand what nefarious influence they were under with Trump. One of the saddest truths is that these men despise the people who love them. They disdain them for giving them their power. Many of us have been amazed that with the pandemic, it's been very obvious he doesn't care if they die. He truly doesn't care if you live or die. Helping people to see that will be important to getting them back to the cause of good government, government that cares about public welfare. That's very different than building bridges to forgive people and saying, okay, we'll just put your racism behind us. That's not what I advocate. I believe we need to deprogram the nation. It's like when people are in a cult and believe all sorts of strange things. We must do something about the massive media propaganda machine that Trump was able to wield so effectively. He could convince people of practically anything. One thing that cults demonstrate is that very intelligent people can be deceived. They may be vulnerable, naive, gullible, have flaws in their character or judgment, but they are not unintelligent. They're under the influence of the cult's propaganda. We should remember this when dealing with the 73 million Trump supporters who voted for him. And also we should remember that we too can be manipulated. We need to educate Americans about propaganda from a nonpartisan perspective. This means recognizing that we are all under the influence of propaganda, because propaganda includes things like messaging and advertising and partisan news programming. According to French philosopher Jacques Ellul, propaganda helps us make sense of the chaotic world. It is inevitably used by everyone. We also need to reach out to the center of the country. I have a number of ideas we can talk about, but I want to make clear that I don't have a problem with Protect the Results canceling the actions they had called for the day after the election. I was, however, concerned about how they seemed to stop everything, including programs to counter Trump's propaganda. It was always after the election, when it became clear that Trump had lost, that the problem would begin. I was worried that their messaging that it was all over would put people to sleep. I feared that we still might need to call for a national strike, and that requires reaching out to the center of the nation, something we never do. I questioned their insistence that we not use the word coup or say that Trump is trying to steal the election. Those things didn't poll well, they said. I was dismayed when, in response to Trump's disinformation about the election, the Democratic Party decided to disseminate disinformation of its own, saying that Trump was only doing these things to raise money. He's spending tons of money, trying to overturn the election. He's doing these things in order to hold on to power. I was amazed at how quickly everyone wanted to get back to politics as usual, as if nothing was happening. 70% of Republicans now believe that the election was fraudulent, and this creates a huge problem for our ability to govern, and it sets the stage for a coup. Trump needs his supporters to back his coup, and we need to counter Trump's propaganda and resist his attempts to overthrow democracy. It's important to remember that even if it doesn't succeed now, these people are going to be back. So I've been working under the assumption that Trump is allied with Putin. I don't think Putin would give up power, and I don't see fascist dictators willingly relinquishing power. I see them running for their lives, but I don't see them peacefully transferring power. Trump, by refusing to concede and declaring the election fraudulent, is holding on to power. I saw Indy Samarajiva speak, and he pointed out that democracy is collapsing around the world, and we are actually late in the cycle. The failure of the Arab Spring to bring democracy to the Middle East, the rise of strongmen around the world like Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines, and Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey, and the shooting of protesters in Nigeria, and the suppression of democracy in Yemen, in the United States, and throughout the Middle East, demonstrates that democracy is under attack around the world. We must find a way to support democracy at home and around the world. We don't want regime change, but we must fight for democracy here and keep our nation from overthrowing democracies and from supporting dictators around the world. And Samarajiva pointed out that our democracy is really little more than 60 years old because Black people didn't get the vote until 60 some odd years ago. Democracy is very young and it's under pressure. What we are experiencing is the global rise of authoritarianism and the collapse of democracy. We are in the throes of that collapse right now. We don't know what Trump would do, so we must be prepared. Even if he prevails this time, we need to hold officials accountable for their crimes and abuses of power. And we must address the weaknesses in our democracy quickly, because they'll be back, and next time they're going to be competent. What I'd like to do now is turn to Alan Minsky and get his comments, then open it up for questions, and then have a discussion.
Rich, I do a lot of these calls with chapters across the country, and I'm on a lot of incredible town halls like the one with Dr. Bill, and I thought there have been excellent town halls that Dr. Bill has hosted, and this week was exceptionally poignant because it really was providing information that I actually think the information about the vaccines is somewhat not being disseminated, because I think there's a worry probably even on major journalism outlets that people will relax even more than they have. And so the promise isn't being presented as clearly as it could be. And so we got some real information on that call that was just spectacular. But Rich, what you just outlined and your summary of the situation, I thought was equally spectacular. There probably wasn't a single word you said, though there was a lot there. At times when somebody produces, I'm a radio veteran, and I know very well that when something is so fertile with ideas that you reflect on them, and sometimes then you get alert back to what you're saying and you'll miss a thought or two. But everything that I latched onto from what you said was incredibly poignant and incredibly accurate. And so there's a lot I can say to add to that or to comment on it, but I really just want to focus on two things. And in a sense, reserve my time for a dialogue where maybe Rich and I can take questions. I don't know what the structure you have planned for the rest of the time is. And that brings me to the content of what you just spoke about. And the first point I'd like to make would really probably be the second point I'd rather make, because I want to talk a little bit about global history and economy and the rise of right-wing authoritarianism around the world. But since I was close to it already, Chuck Schumer, you know, who over time is certainly far, far, far from being one of my favorite Democrats late in the election cycle, you know, had some really decent signaling for Chuck Schumer. And he said that the three priorities of a Democratic-controlled Senate were going to be climate, COVID, and economy, which he somehow combined, because obviously economy should really be a subject unto its own too. And then the third one was democracy. And I was very happy, especially to hear him signal on climate and democracy. And the House passed as its first order of business in the last Congress, H.R. 1, which was a bill that was really targeting a lot of the Republican strategies to undermine American democracy, preceding the arrival of Donald Trump and then becoming more extreme after Trump. It was a pretty darn good bill. Wasn't perfect, but it really addressed so many things about the ways in which our system was corroding and has been corroding. And the reason I bring that up, and this is what's so important about PDA chapters like PDA East LA County, every PDA chapter everywhere, is the Democratic Party, really until the 2016 election and the appearance of Trump. In other words, Trump is an interloper into the system of American political, the club of American political elites. And he is worse. The Republican Party was horrible. He's an outgrowth of that political trajectory. Chris Kobach and him are soulmates, no doubt. Kobach obviously was a major Republican operative in the middle of the country. The strategies that brought about the stealing of the 2000 election are related to what HR1 is addressing. But between 2000, a stolen election in the guy's brother's state, where the brother was the governor, and the way that they were proceeding, the way they were trying to, win on the margins by suppressing votes in Florida, which, the work of Greg Palast is right on point here, because he's exposing the scrubbing the rolls, attacking politically underrepresented communities of color and the capacity to vote there. And then the scrubbing of the voting rolls through the insanity of ex-felons not being allowed to vote. And then the exploitation of that through name proximities. It's just an absolute abomination and of democracy targeted for the sole purpose of having Republicans win elections over Democrats in this usually very close races that the two-party system generates. But for 16 years, between 2000 and 2016, you can even get quotes very close to, Hillary Clinton and the Obamas saying that they really aren't going to make this a major public issue because we're worried it will suppress people's confidence in democracy and then they won't vote. So until you get to the 2016 election, the upper power structures of the Democratic Party were largely unresponsive to an unfolding crisis of democracy in the country. By the time Nancy Pelosi becomes the head of the House of Representatives in 2018, you see with HR1, they're taking it seriously at least. But the progressives were serious about it in those intervening 16 years. And it's the progressive wing of the Democratic Party that has got to insist in our more strengthened stature that we have within the party and be adamant. This is not wealth redistribution. This is not Medicare for all. This is democracy. These issues are all interrelated and they shouldn't be siloed. But they come up in different ways. We have to be honest about that. That's how subjects come up. And we have to force the Democratic Party with all of its weight to strengthen democracy everywhere they can. And we cannot allow them to go home, as it were, which I think a lot of the rank and file Democratic activists are going to do right now. The progressives won't go home, and the progressives have to insist upon democracy. So the other major point I want to comment on is, and in herein I want to say, I think Rich has made an incredible presentation, has thought through this systematically over the last few weeks. And obviously I've been on calls with Rich and I noticed his absolutely on point vigilance on these subjects. And Russell Green, who I work with very closely, PDA's senior strategic advisor on climate, he works only on climate for really about 6 weeks heading into the election. Something just impressed upon him, and he became, like Rich, just laser focused on Trump's attempts to steal the election, the need to defeat Trump, and the need for vigilance on the fronts that Rich outlined as an introduction to preserve democracy, to prevent Trump's attempts to achieve a coup. As the executive director of PDA, all I can say is I fully endorse and have endorsed everything that PDA can do to be as vigilant as possible, to support all the movements that are taking place, to recognize what Trump is still, obviously, to the present, trying to do, what he was trying to set the table for leading up into the election. And he is further down the road towards authoritarianism than any major Republican Party leader we've had today. This obviously does play with his obsessive infantile narcissism, which doesn't make him any less threatening. I think, Benito Mussolini suffered from the same kinds of blatant narcissism, and you had 20 years of fascist dictatorship in Italy, which inspired the Nazi regime, et cetera, right? This is an incredibly dangerous historical figure. And the fact that he's absurd and it's clownish and it's foolish doesn't make it any less threatening. He just got 73 million votes, 10 or 11 more million votes than he did last time. And he is clearly trying to subvert democracy. Everything Rich said too about it not coming back readily. Democratic societies are the rarity historically. They're very fragile. Now, before this election cycle, my predilection in addressing this issue was to focus on the fact that economic oligarchy and democracy are like oil and water and they don't blend. And I do think one of the reasons we're seeing the corrosion of democracies around the world is because of the extreme disparities in wealth that exist in many countries. And the United States, obviously this has been an incredibly flawed democracy throughout its history, but there was a novelty to what was generated here in 1776 and 1787 with the Constitution. And then obviously the civil rights movement, as Rich pointed out, and of course the women's suffragettes movement to win the vote for women in the 1920 election when that was launched, fulfill the democratic, they don't fulfill it. They advance the possibility of actual real democracy in the United States occurring. But because it is viewed as being a democratic republic from once the Constitution sets in place, how the government is going to operate and be renewed, the corrosion of democracy in the United States is really the profound consequences for humanity and democracy across the world are just catastrophic. You see Europe had fascism in the middle of last century, pretty much conquered the entire continent in the early years of World War II. And you see the fragility of European democracies with the rise of, you know, Marie Le Pen, Salvini in Italy, the Eastern European governments, et cetera. So democracy and then Bolsonaro down in South America, and really still not that many democratic republics operating in East Asia. You have Modi in India, who I'm forgetting the name of the acronym, but his is really the most advanced fascist type government to a degree that, you know, Putin and the Eastern Europeans do not match him for the brown shirt. What's the name of the organization? It has a three-letter acronym, and it's the second largest membership organization in India, and it's a support mechanism for the Hindu Nationalist Party that Modi comes out of. And they're basically like organized like brown shirt gangs around India. It's a ethno-religious terrorism that the Muslim community is experiencing across India. And of course, he's highly normalized as head of state, more, for instance, than Bolsonaro is, I think, around the world. And Bolsonaro is incredibly, incredibly, incredibly dangerous himself. Obviously, he's a full-on open fetishist of the fascist dictatorships in Brazil that existed in the supported by the CIA in the second half of the 20th century. So defeating Trump was so essential because he was the international figurehead, more than Modi, more than Bolsonaro, more than Putin, of this authoritarian tendency and the fact that he was the president of the United States of America, the oldest operating democratic republic in the world, was hyper significant. You even had in the UK the candidate who most resembled him win their national election. Boris Johnson, I don't think, quite represents the same kind of thing that Trump does to the structures of democracy in the UK. He's still a dangerous character, in my opinion. You know, my predilection was to tie it to economic oligarchy, but I, you know, having lived through the last 3 months of the really existing statements by Donald Trump, I have to be a little weary of my tendency to do that. I mean, because I think sometimes these forces do become detached from their material foundations that may be informing the arrival of this kind of right-wing authoritarianism. I think there become partisan connections that are made, which is what's happening, I think, with the Republican base and the relationship of the Republican base and its proto-fascism to American structural racism is extremely profound. And again, not a direct one-to-one connection to the, you know, the pulling apart of the middle class in the United States and the establishment of oligarchy. In fact, many, many people who are more wealthy are not voting for the Republican Party. They're actually voting for the Democratic Party. You know, the class striation is different. Not that it wasn't that there weren't similar aspects, say, in Italy and in Germany in the 20s and 30s, where you had, you know, some of the more prosperous professional classes not gravitating to the fascist parties. So in some senses, that mirrors that period. And there's no doubt that oligarchy and democracy are like oil and water. And so I do think one thing we have to do is advocate for a more justified distribution of wealth. And so while I do sort of have this economism as a default tendency in my thinking, I'm trying to both be to present and simultaneously be aware of and its possible blind spots. I do think one of the things we have to do is establish in the Democratic Party political policies that make clear to people across the center of the country that they are beneficial for their communities and for their welfare of their families going forward. The neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party not only has failed to do that, not only do their policies not achieve that, not only do their policies basically not address the endemic inequalities in American society, at best they manage them and maintain them, whatever they may be, you know, mass homelessness, mass incarceration, massive wealth inequality, a healthcare system that just bilks everybody that can be built. You know, basically the moderate wing of the Democratic Party, I do think you're pretty much putting yourself on if you think they really are going to change any of that equation. So we have to push for policies in the Democratic Party that change that equation. And I think we do at the same time, and this is a bit of a political juggling act, and I notice you're wearing a Biden-Harris shirt, we have to embrace our allies in an alliance against the fascists. So I do think it is a period of advocating as strongly as we can for progressive policies within the Democratic Party, building up the Democratic Party as a bulwark against a proto-fascist takeover of the country, and trying to just explain to the neoliberals, look, your political ideology got us in a mess, a hot mess. We have to try something much more equitable and try to win progressive policies through the operation of the Democratic Party. So it's certainly not as coherent a presentation as what Rich provided, because that was beautiful. But thank you so much for setting the table with so many profound observations about the time we're living in and the absolute necessity for vigilance and political engagement. So thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Marlene.
Hi. I want to play devil's advocate for just a moment. Rich, in your comments, they're wonderful. But I think I don't see Trump as trying to lead a coup in the same way you see it, as actually thinking he's going to remain in office. Now, he's still going to, that if that's a possibility, you know, he'd still try, but I don't think that's what he's trying to do. His coup is being the de facto controller of that office, even of the seat of power when he leaves. If the Democrats can't take the Senate, he will control the fiscal policy of this country. He can't quite control the monetary policy because he's not totally able to undermine Powell. But what will happen is the fiscal policy can so be destroyed, and he has been doing that. He and the Republicans are enabling. He hasn't the knowledge base to totally understand it. But when you so destroy it, it can eventually undermine the monetary policy enough to we end up with things like negative interest rates and all that. But that's one thing. The other thing is this man is so desperate, more than making money off of his being in office, the reason he wouldn't wear a mask is so he was so desperate to get out and do rallies, not just to win the election, but even more so because I think there's some bipolarism or something there. He goes into depression and he has to have people lauding and heralding him. That's what keeps him going. And just as important, I think that's the main thing. He needs to be of importance. And so this is why he's doing all this destructiveness now to destroy so much of our system, whether it's getting rid of those planes that do the oversight over Russia and all the conflict areas of the world, whether it's doing all the destructive stuff he's doing within the government, to whether it's the destroying and getting rid of all the scientists, all of this. It is to create a system where He has the support of people who are interested in the monetary part of it for their own enrichment, but so many of them, because of their fear of the demographic changes in our country or their economic situations. But the point is that it allows him to keep, the Democrats are going to spend their time putting up fires. They're not going to be able to accomplish anything. So the only way I can see us going forward, if we don't take the Senate, is we're going to have to find a state or two that enact policies like single payer system, something where people start seeing that they like the effect on that on their lives. We're not going to be able to educate the public. That's not going to work. We're only talking to our own choir in that. That's not where we need to do. We need to concentrate on some issues that can be accomplished within a state, because if we can't take the Senate, it's not going to happen nationwide. We'll spend our time putting out fires. The conflict is there, and that's how he stays in control. And he is destroying our financial system. Sorry about that, but I don't see it the way you do, that it's a matter of educating. It's not going to happen that way. All right. I'd like to hear in others' opinions on that.
Yeah. Well, I just want to respond quickly to that, because I think that he is trying to overthrow the government. I think that that's his plan. Yeah, but he's not, but he may not be able to do it. So I think that's one distinction there. I also think he's working with Putin. So I think that this destroying of our economy is related to that. And I also think he's setting up a situation where he can come back, and also creating a terrible problem for our ability to govern. We have half the population thinking that Biden is illegitimate.
Yeah, and that will stay. That's the problem. That's going to stay even when he's out of office.
If I could chime in, I think Rich and I probably have a little bit of a disagreement on the Putin thing. I do think that they're in league, but the degree to which they are, I think sometimes is more, sometimes is less. And I think the fact of President Trump wants to rule the world. He doesn't want to be Vladimir Putin's puppet. You know, this is just crazy Mussolini-esque, Napoleonic type narcissism. Sorry for bringing a new historical figure into it. I don't want to get into a debate about Napoleon, but I do think Marlene, if he could, he would have, is what I view about.
Yes, I agree with you. Yeah. But most likely it's not going to happen that way, but he still will have achieved in a coup, in regardless of the fact that he can't stay in office.
Here's how bad I think he's advanced this, though. I think that he has really put forward the question much more aggressively and rapidly in the disintegration of our democracy than we thought we would ever be at this point. And the reason he can't, I think, is largely because the United States of America and the real powers in our society that are attendant to how the military-industrial complex of the United States dominates the globe militarily, and that American corporate holdings dominate the world globally. I know that's not the same extent that it did in the high period after World War II, but it's still pretty extreme. I mean, the wealthiest people in the world, let alone the most powerful corporations in the world, are still disproportionately American. And so the people who play that game, they just want to hold on to that power and that wealth, or at least a significant portion of them do. Some of them don't. Some of them may be honest, sincere Democrats. But the degree to which democracy has served their interests, certainly undergird democracy, American democracy, has served the achievement of that power, they're not really willing to give it up, right? Even if they would rather maybe in some aspect of their soul be like authoritarians, they recognize that the American democratic system has served their international power. The horrid thing that was the Bush-Cheney administration wrapped itself up in democracy. They stole an election in America, and then they were, quote unquote, spreading democracy around the world at the point of a gun. And now Trump is completely countering that. He's presented the prospect of American power outside of democracy And it's now part of our vocabulary and our reality as a prospect, much more than I ever thought it would be by this
point. Yeah. And the bigger danger, I think, is that with this instability that he's created and the fomenting of violence in many, many ways, regardless of what corporate America does, which would like some stability, there will be instability because of the total confusion and hatred he will continue for, and the continued foaming of doubt, of trust of anything. And that eventually is just going to deepen the divide, economic divide. And when you have the Republicans in the Senate keeping there from being any economic progress, you're going to have a deeper, a level of poverty in this country and a deeper level of anxiety. And it's going to lead to more desperation and probably different forms of not necessarily violence, but enough instability that more things are not going to work. And that's where he maintains the power. And he keeps a government from functioning at all, unless he can stay in office, which I think he kind of knows, but he's still trying to do it, but it's not going to work that way. But he still will be in de facto control of too much of this country. And that's our biggest problem.
Yeah, I think part of the reason he's not conceding is obviously narcissism. He can't admit that he lost. But I also think that we need to find a way to reach out to the center of the country, 73 million people.
That's only going to be through our being able to do something in some kind of a state or not. It's probably not going to happen unless we can win in Georgia, both races.
Let's see, we have Lynn, and then I see Ellie raise his hand. So let's go with Lynn Heidenkooper.
Right, Heidenkooper. Okay. Thanks for letting me talk. I'm really worried about the Supreme Court setting to hear arguments on Trump's plan to exclude undocumented immigrants from census, because that will determine the whole makeup of the House. How do you feel that they're going to vote?
Well, that might go for Alan, because I really don't know.
Terribly is how I feel, though.
Ellie, you wanna speak?
Yeah, we're just going to, off the tail end of what you were saying, Rich, about, you know, in a sort of speak, pandering to the center. I totally agree that we have to do that. And I just think how we do mechanically is by actually being better propagandists. I don't think there's a way to avoid propaganda as a means of disseminating information to the masses. The masses want to be emotionally soothed. They want to be empowered. They want the collective self-esteem to aggrandize. They do not want to be lectured to. And to the extent that we try to educate people and letting them know what this is, what's going on, they can see it as quasi-intellectual stuff. And we are really only as good as consolidated in an anti-fascistic front, if you will, to the degree that we are not diffused and not insular. So we just got to be better at doing what Trump does for Trumpism to abate. That's my two cents.
Okay, thank you, Ellie. I'm more thinking about educating people generally so that they can recognize it, because obviously it's going to continue to exist, and we do have to use it ourselves. Hopefully we use it ethically.
Yeah, I wanted to say on that, if I may. So yes, obviously in principle, I'm for educating people, of course, and it's just a matter of how we do it. And we don't want to seem like we're, pontificating, and we don't want to be seen as the, you know, the West Coast leaders telling other people how to do things. So yes, it's how you do it versus what you're trying to do. Okay. That sometimes gets across.
Thank you, Ellie. Danette.
I'm kind of in between you, Marlene, and Alan. I'm kind of a mixture of all of you. It is very troubling, just like Alan put in the chat right now. I think I agree with Marlene on the whole Senate thing. If we don't get the Senate, we're dead in the water in more ways than one. But I wanted to bring up the point that the Republicans have been working at this for decades, from even before Reagan. And that's kind of their MO, even though they're supposedly the party of limited government, they would love nothing more than to take over everything. And Mitch McConnell has done a lot of damage over the past, he's been in since the 90s. And I think that you're right. I don't think Trumpism is ever going away. He's been bolding these people. They're here to stay. Unfortunately, they have that cult mentality, and that cult mentality is very hard to reason with. I think that education is going to be limited in terms of convincing them otherwise that their mindset is not correct. The more that you try to reason with them, the more they dig their heels in. So I don't think that's going to work. I don't know. I'm at a loss on that point of how to reach these people. I think they're kind of a lost cause, unfortunately. And we do still have the danger. I think people are very naive if they're breathing a sigh of relief right now. Hopefully Biden does get into office, but that's not going to solve any of our problems. Those problems are still there. The foundation is still rotten. The foundation needs to be ripped out and rebuilt. I don't know. I don't have the answers. I just keep working towards what we need to keep working toward and get as many people on board to help us, because that's the only thing that's going to work. But thank you.
If I could tackle that a little bit, is that okay, Rich?
Yes, please.
The 1980 election, which Reagan won, there was a complete wipeout of the Democratic Party across the Great Plains. I mean, a few states Democrats held on, but they're really solid progressives like Frank Church and George McGovern got knocked out. The Democratic Party, after Clinton came into office, you look at the electoral map of Clinton's victory then, of course, it was a strange victory because he probably only won because of the presence of the billionaire guy who ran, I'm forgetting his name, sorry, the anti-NAFTA guy. And yet you look at it, it doesn't resemble what just became solidified as the blue and red states. And partly because Clinton was from the South, right, from Arkansas. He picked up some states in the South. But the Democratic Party in its policies wasn't worse than the Republican Party, but was not responsive to the needs of the working class as a huge part of the country declined. And when you look at what happens politically in periods of decline and where people, you know, their political attachments end up, if there's no left option, you know, the thing that knocked out McGovern and Church and all those guys was the political mobilization of evangelical Christians, which, I mean, talk about a paradox in the 1980 election, right? You had Jimmy Carter being rejected by evangelical Christians, but you did. And if unions were in decline across the industrial Midwest, West Virginia was the bluest state in the country as late as the Clinton years. Now it was the second most highest vote total percent for Trump. Only Wyoming topped it, I think. And that's because unions are gone. There's basically the Democratic Party has had no public policy strategy to reverse the decline of West Virginia society and the general wealth of the population there. And the only institutions they're carrying have been evangelical Christian churches. I mean, this is probably now on your turf, Rich. You probably know a lot more about it than I do. But if there is an industrial policy in the United States that is sparked by the necessity of the large infrastructure programs and a Green New Deal, so the green energy economy, and there's domestic industrial production, you know, it's not a question of just sending these factories to the places that have rejected the Democratic Party. They obviously need to be hopefully distributed in ways across the country. But if the federal government has any role and the Democratic Party can have any say in where they go, and of course that's pretty far afield from neoliberal ideology, but if it can happen, we really have to try to get them into places where, you know, you'll see a turnaround in the economy and the decline will be staunch. In other words, they don't need to be on the Atlantic coast or the Pacific coast, where the economies have been doing much, much better than they have in the middle of the country. And there's a few other parts of the country that have been doing well. Texas, though, might be hurting once the oil economy is not in play. Again, that kind of industrial policy is where we're a long ways away from that, but it's something to think about in terms of taking the center of the country, which, given the Electoral College, given the census year just occurred and the incapacity of the Democratic Party to overturn state legislatures across the middle of the country, we're in for a rough ride in terms of turning the center of the country around unless we actually see, you know, real social and economic improvements in the lives of the people across the middle of the country. Colorado also is a place in the middle of the country that, yeah, isn't suffering the economic deterioration of the states to the east and the northeast of Colorado. Societies that go into decline and then there's no left option, it's a pretty ugly equation right there.
This has been Bible Study for Progressives. If you enjoyed the program, please subscribe to our podcast or put us in your favorites and write a 5-star review. Tell your friends about us and share us on social media. Follow us on Facebook and click the donate button at modernlectionaries.blogspot.com. Your support will help us reach more people, produce more and better shows, and cover the cost of production. Feel free to send me a note or comment on the show. I would love to hear from you. Until next time, this is Rich Procida. Thank you for listening.